Hi friends, Andy here. First, the usual reminder that neither Jody nor I are physicians and none of the following should be taken as medical advice. Please talk to a physician if you have concerns about your health with regard to COVID-19 or any other conditions. Second, your local health department, as always, is the best source of information for the current trends in your area, current case counts and things. There's always some delay between recording and releasing these episodes, and so my discussion of numbers may not be the most up-to-date for your area. And in particular, there have been some updates regarding the vaccine between when we first recorded this and when we were able to release it. We discussed preliminary results on the Pfizer vaccine. Since then, more final numbers have come in, putting the vaccine about 95% effective. And approval for emergency authorization has been sought or is being sought, and so we should get an answer on that in a couple weeks. The Moderna vaccine also announced preliminary results, putting it at also about 95 or 94% effective. So very similar effectiveness and safety profiles for both vaccines, at least based on the preliminary results and the more final results from Pfizer. So all very exciting, and hopefully we'll have even more updates and more positive results going forward. Now here's the episode, and as always, the theme song by Jonathan Colton. DNA, you're in my heart. DNA, infector in every part of my body. Cell has a nucleus, each nucleus is chromosomes. DNA, baby, that spells DNA. Hi, and welcome to episode 24 of BioBreak, a conversation with your friendly neighborhood biologist. I'm Andy Walsh, and here again with my wife, Jody.
Hi.
Hi, Jody. How you doing?
I was just saying you should say you're Dr. Andy.
I'm Dr. Andy Walsh. I have one of them there, PhDs.
Hey, I was there when you were working very hard for that, so.
Yes, you were. And you were very supportive through that whole long process.
Maybe I can be called Master Jody Walsh. Maybe not.
There should be some kind of title for I made it possible for somebody to get a PhD. Yeah, that should have its own.
No, I'm saying I got my master's, so I should be master.
Oh, you're okay. Yes,
that's not I'm all sorry. About you.
I'm sorry. I didn't topic switch quick enough.
Yeah, I keep up.
Yeah, I did. My apologies. Yes, you also have a master's in art education. Should we go through our whole CV this episode? It's only been 24 episodes, maybe we should.
You know, I think this is kind of what happens, you know, month 9 of quarantine.
Yeah, we probably also
nine
need...
9 or 8?
By my reckoning, we are 8 months into things. It was 8 months ago yesterday that the, well, I guess Friday.
Eight months ago Friday,
that a lot of the stay-at-home orders and the school closings and the things came into effect here in Pennsylvania. It was that second week of March, from like the 7th to the 14th, that things went from, oh yeah, there's a virus out there and there's people in the United States that have it, but it seems to be mostly, you know, in the New York City and West Coast areas too. Exponential growth and lack of testing meant that there were more cases than we knew about and all kinds of things. So that was 8 months ago. We are 8 months in, and, you know, the level of quarantine and various things have obviously changed several times through that, and depending on where you live, may have been different or may have changed even more. But here we are. And we've had some developments. It's been a busy week this past week in the world of SARS coronavirus 2. After
literally and...
Yeah. So where would you like to start?
So is this the second wave? Is this the third wave?
Well, you know, it depends.
Is this the first tsunami?
It depends on where you live, as always. Mm-hmm. You know, some places are seeing a second uptick in cases. Some places are seeing their third uptick in cases. You know, if you look at the chart for the entire United States, we've had three periods of increase in case counts, daily case counts. The first was back in March. The second was in that May-June period. And now the third one, you know, started maybe late September or October, depending on what you're looking and exactly where the, you know, where you count the inflection point is happening. We're now nationally in our third period of growth in case counts per day. We've reached the highest numbers that we've ever seen in the country nationally. The other day, it was 160,000 new cases were added in a single day. You know, we're definitely closing in on 200,000 as a possibility per day if you know, growth continues at even a fraction of the pace that it's been over the past couple weeks.
We've reached a point where even in like smaller, more rural, less populous areas, they're seeing increases in cases.
Well, I mean, that was, you know, it depended on where you were. There were small areas that were seeing large numbers of cases, you know, earlier in the year. It just, there were, you know, localized outbreaks in smaller towns and in rural areas, or even in things like, you know, places like prisons and workplaces and other areas where there's lots of people in a small, that are congregating together in a small place, even though they represent, even though there's not a lot of population in general, there's not a lot of population density in that area, in that zip code or that county or what have you, there is a place where a lot of people come together at least for a time in a high density population, whether that's voluntarily or otherwise. And so we, you know, there were some rural areas that had the highest, you know, rates per population of infections, even, you know, back in April, May, and June time periods.
But I was thinking, you know, like just looking at the maps that I've seen on like New York Times and some of these other sites, you know, it really is, it's growing everywhere.
There are many parts of the country that are experiencing increases in daily case counts.
Although I actually haven't checked. I thought Maine was doing all right, you know, a while ago. I don't know if they're still doing okay up there.
Vermont and Maine had been keeping things very low for a long period of time. You know, some of the states, some of the mountain states are still just so, you know, sparsely populated that they don't have many counts, or at least, you know, many cases or many places where there are lots of cases. But, you know, even fairly sparsely populated places like North and South Dakota have been seeing big increases in cases since August, that, you know, their numbers have been going up. Places like New York and New Jersey that had kept things relatively level all throughout the spring and summer, you know, after that first peak in March and April for them, their numbers came down over the course of April and through May, and then stayed low through May, June, July, August, September, and then starting, you know, again, New Jersey and New York are on slightly different timetables, so it's not exactly the same for both places, but, you know, over the past month or so, both places have started to see increases, not to the same extent, you know, on a per population basis, as we've seen in places like North and South Dakota and Wisconsin, but definitely increasing to the point that there is some concern again for those areas. And yeah, but you know, it's spreading in lots of parts of the country. Many states have recorded the most cases that they've seen ever in this you know, outbreak in the past week or the past 2 weeks. And so it is not a localized phenomenon. Although exactly what you're experiencing will depend on what's happening in your community. But yeah, it's no longer just a problem for a handful of states or a handful of cities. It's definitely an issue in much of the country and much of the world. You know, many European countries are seeing increases in cases or have seen increases in cases over the past month or so. To levels, you know, at or higher than what they had seen back in February and March. You know, some of the island nations of the Southern Hemisphere are doing fairly well in terms of their case counts, partly because they're isolated, partly because it's summertime there, partly because they just took a hard line, you know, fairly early on and had the ability to do so because of their geographic isolation. The Eastern Asian countries seem to be doing fairly well, even those that are experiencing or going into their winter, you know, fall, winter, just the same as that we are. They seem to have had more success with wider spread testing protocols, wider spread contact tracing, more thorough and rapid contact tracing, more extensive testing. And so they're not seeing the same surges to the same levels, not seeing the same increases in case counts on a daily basis that have been seen in other parts of the world. hopefully for them that continues. We'll see. But that, you know, that seems to be kind of the state of the world at the moment.
But, like, you know, even though this is all, you know, kind of scary, kind of, I guess, you know, intimidating to see, you know, cases and, you know, thinking about that, you know, with each number that you see, there's a person and a family attached to that number. It's not uncontrollable. I mean, we can, just like we did earlier, you know, in this year, that's, you know, it's the whole time to flatten the curve thing.
Right. The virus hasn't changed. You know, these numbers are not due to significant changes in the virus. You know, we are looking for that. That is, you know, in the broad scheme of things, that is a possibility, right? Biologically, the virus can mutate, and that can change its pathogenicity, how serious of an illness it causes, things like how infectious it is. And, you know, we have not seen evidence, the people who have looked have not seen evidence of mutations that have significant differences in causing more disease. Maybe some change might have become slightly more contagious, but it doesn't seem to have become any more deadly or make people more sick. So the numbers of cases aren't just a function of, although something about the virus has changed. So human behavior is still the biggest factor in whether any particular person gets infected or not. You know, it's have they been exposed to someone that has the virus? And were they exposed in a context where transmission was likely, or were they exposed in a context where transmission is unlikely? Were mitigation efforts put into place to limit the risk of that transmission, even though there was some interaction with somebody who had the virus? You know, so things like, were both parties wearing a mask? How far apart were they? Were they indoors or outdoors? What was the air circulation like? What was the ambient temperature? That may be a factor. We don't know that for sure, but that, you know, is a factor in terms of some other viruses, or possibly maybe not so much the temperature as the relative humidity.
I was just going to say, does that have something to do with how much humidity is in the air? I would think that viruses would do better in humid, but is that wrong?
Well, it depends. There's the issue of the, you know, the little droplets that the virus is being spread in drying out sooner if the air is drier. There's also the issue of our mucous membranes drying out more because the air is dry. And so they're not as protective. They don't have as much of that protective layer as a physical barrier to the virus infection. So that's where, you know, it kind of has impacts in both directions potentially.
Yeah, and so, and even with the increase, you know, I've followed some of what Dr. Fauci has been saying, and some other, you know, public health experts, other, you know, epidemiologists, and nobody is saying we need to completely shut down like we did, like many places did back in March. You know, what I've been hearing is a lot of just, you know, on our own, like choosing how individually we do things so that, you know, we can still keep, you know, businesses can still do the things that they need to do. But it's just these little things like, you know, getting together with friends that we haven't been, you know, quarantining with, or, you know, getting together, you know, for like other big events inside together.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the story is the same. It's been for a while. You know, early on, it was less clear exactly how contagious the virus was. And so there were, you know, we implemented the most cautious protocols on the possibility that the virus was fairly contagious, that a fairly brief interaction between two people could lead to transmission. We now understand, you know, better that that doesn't seem to be the case, that brief, you know, 1 or 2 minute interactions between people, it's unlikely that there's enough opportunity for enough virus to be transmitted from one person to another. Not to say it's completely impossible, but it's much less likely. You basically have to have somebody who is shedding a very large quantity of virus, more than the typical person is when they're infected, or you have to have somebody who is just very, very susceptible to infection for whatever reason. It would be the most likely scenarios in which that would transmission would happen in that very brief interaction. The more typical scenario is a prolonged interaction, so that there's time for multiple of these little droplets carrying some virus to accumulate, you know, in their transmission from one person to another, so that you eventually get enough to hit the infectious dose, which seems to be more than just one individual particle. You have to get a whole bunch of those virus particles at once or over a relatively short period of time, enough so that it kind of overwhelms your body's initial physical barriers to infection. And that can be one, you know, as we talked about a couple episodes ago, that can be one prolonged interaction of more than 15 minutes, or that could be several shorter interactions over, you know, the course of a couple hours with several different people, or the same person, you know, mm-hmm. but interrupted in between. Now, of course, if it's with several people, all several of those people have to be infected, right? If I, you know, and that was that case, you know, that came from that case of that physician in a prison who was interacting with multiple inmates who were ill, right? So no, it doesn't look like one single interaction was enough to infect the physician, but several of them were. But that's because several of those people were infected, right? So if you interact with several people, but not all of them are infected, then you're not necessarily at risk. But you don't necessarily know who's infected or not, because as we've talked about on many occasions, it is possible to be shedding virus in significant quantities even without being ill yourself, without feeling sick.
I thought this was fascinating when I was reading an article this week about what the initial shutdown was doing. You know, in addition to, you know, lowering the curve, we were also, you know, buying time because this was a novel virus that nobody had, you know, experience with. And so what this did was give our medical professionals some time to understand, you know, and try different things for how best to treat it. And this was really interesting. This was an article that was in The Atlantic. So if anybody wants to look for it, of course, I don't know the name of it, but they were interviewing somebody, I don't remember if it was a nurse or a doctor, but they were saying how when they were initially looking at cases, they would go to like message boards or like, you know, these medical message boards where they would have to like scroll through like, okay, we tried this, we tried this, we tried this. And like you're scrolling and scrolling to try and get an answer for what to do in these real time patient situations. And they're like, we don't have to do that right now. Like we have the means, but now it's just that, you know, for some of these hospitals and some of the places around the country, it's another kind of time that they need. And
right. Yeah. So, you know, part of the hard mitigation efforts, early on were, about, you know, not understanding exactly how contagious things was. And now, you know, we understand that, you know, retail interactions and different things can be safe, you know, if you're spaced apart from people, most of the time, and, you know, appropriate protection is between you and the cashiers and all those kinds of things. It also had a function exactly right of providing some time for the public health infrastructure and healthcare infrastructure to kind of catch up with what's the best standard of care, how can we best take care of these patients. And even making sure that we had some more time to manufacture things like personal protective equipment. You know, what we realized fairly early on was that was a limiting factor globally. There were just a few places, many of which were in Eastern Asia or in Europe, not very many of them here in the United States, that manufactured the gloves and the masks and the different things that we needed to protect our healthcare workers and then to protect the wider public. And so we needed some time to kind of figure out a plan B for sourcing those things, for manufacturing them, and so forth. And we've had some time now. We still don't have quite the level of equipment that we had targeted for. They had set some targets, like 300 million units of a stockpile. I don't know exactly mm-hmm. what the unit consists of there, but that was the target number that I'd seen. And you know, nationally, we have not hit that number. We were less than half at the last I checked. But we have more than we did. We have more of a stockpile than we did at the beginning of the year. And so, you know, that was a function of or that was the purpose of trying to stop things fairly early on. And yeah, you know, one good outcome is that because we understand the disease better, because our healthcare professionals understand the disease better, we're getting better outcomes. Not as many people as a percentage of cases are dying now as were way back in February, March, April. And that is at least partly because we know better how to treat these people so that they aren't as at risk. So they're getting effective treatment early on, and so we're not having to fumble through, well, we tried this and it didn't work, we tried that and it didn't work. And we also, you know, for much of the past 5 or 6 months, we haven't had the heavy hospital volume that puts more pressure on things. We've had the opportunity that every patient can have whatever equipment it is that they need to, and whatever treatments they need to get that high level of care. We are, unfortunately, at least in some parts of the country, hitting a point where that's not the case necessarily, or we're at risk of that not being the case soon. Hospitalization rates are up, and so hospitals are going to start to become more crowded. In some places, they already are crowded, or at least operating at or near capacity. And so you're going to have to maybe start having the situations again where not everybody has access to that highest possible standard of care. And hopefully that won't be the case. And hopefully we can, you know, make the human behavior choices that will help to prevent that. But yeah, that is still a concern, at least in some of the highest volume, places with the highest volume of cases at the moment, is that they're starting to, you know, there have been, not just starting, for weeks now, there have been reports in some of these places of hospitals are getting close to capacity again. Protective gear for nurses and physicians is running low again, or they're kind of projecting out, if we're using them at this rate, we are not going to make it through the winter with the supplies that are currently available, things like that. So that's why, you know, it's still a concern, even though the fatality rate is not as high as it was, still doesn't mean that we can just say, well, then, you know, everybody can get this and it'll be fine, and we can, you know, move forward.
So maybe we should talk about, like, numbers, because I think it's clearly evident that we as a community, as a society, have trouble with numbers and big numbers and understanding, like, how best to look at them. Because, you know, there's still lots of stories going around where, oh, this isn't necessarily an increase in cases, this is just more testing. But as somebody who looks at numbers, who thinks in numbers, I feel like you understand and know and can extrapolate the important information that we need to know from the numbers. And this is, you know, and whenever you're looking at these numbers, you're also, you know, you understand that, you know, there can be like mistakes made with some of the numbers. Sure. I guess that's where, you know, we get a lot of, or I can hear, you know, some people saying, well, you know, they're just miscounting or.
Right. So there's a lot there. Where to start? So we can start with a couple of things, a couple of simple observations. One, they're doing a lot of testing in some other countries and they're not seeing these increases in cases. Like we talked about that, you know, many of the Eastern Asian countries, China, Vietnam, South Korea, other countries in that part of the world have been doing a lot of testing and have seen their case numbers stay low, suggestive of an actual lack of transmission, that transmission is under control in those countries.
And that's part of that lives. That testing is beyond just testing where they think there are symptoms. That's testing random places in the community.
They, you know, early on there were reports from South Korea of, you know, extensive, like, we're just going to drive up to a community and test everybody here, or test one out of every five people here, whatever, you know, whatever their supplies and capacity allowed at the time. But they were doing a lot more randomized testing than just if you're sick and you show up at the hospital, that's when we'll give you a test. In China, there have been reports of, like, entire cities, you know, they're just, okay, there were some cases in this area, so now we're just going to come in and test everybody so that we understand where the virus is and how to best control transmission from there. And so you would expect that if it were just a function of testing, that they would see big spikes in cases from that. And they have not, by and large, from those kinds of efforts.
That's not really a strategy that I've seen that we're doing here.
That is not the strategy that on any sort of large scale we've employed in this country.
Apart from, like, I think we've heard, like, some colleges have been able to do that.
Right. In specific locations and specific contexts, there have been more of that kind of testing. Like, as you say, university and college campuses. They did a lot of testing of students when they first arrived, whenever their fall semester started this year. If people were coming onto campus, a lot of those schools were testing people when they came onto campus. Some of them have continued to do randomized testing or, you know, whole scale, you know, we're going to test everybody on a repeated basis. And so some of that may be picking up more cases than we would have found with our, well, we're just going to test the people who have symptoms approach. Sure. Because, you know, that is, there probably is some amount of asymptomatic people getting identified through that kind of testing. So, you know, we'll come back to that in a minute. But yes, it, you know, and again, we talked about if we were doing no testing, we would have no cases. And then we started to do testing, we'd have some cases. And so, yes, there are, you know, areas at which testing, you know, does reveal cases that you wouldn't have otherwise known about. At the same time, we need to know about those cases so that we can do control. So we don't want to just say, if you're doing
no testing and not finding cases, that doesn't mean that there's no virus, right, and everything's hunky-dory.
Right. It just means you don't know where how much there is and where it is and so forth. So we can look at that. So yeah, so some colleges, universities, some workplaces, you know, the NBA, you know, NFL, these places are doing a lot more extensive testing on a very limited population. But nationally, we just haven't engaged in that kind of strategy. One of the big differences there is that many of those countries in Asia experienced outbreaks of the first SARS coronavirus back in the early 2000s, or, you know, their neighboring country did, and so they wanted to make sure that they were prepared. Some of them have also had some experience with MERS, another coronavirus that causes a respiratory illness, but has very limited human-to-human transmission. And so it is a virus in camels that some people have gotten from interactions with camels. And then there's been some spread from person to person, but at a limited amount that it's a self-limiting outbreak. And so, but those countries have had experience with those viruses, with those outbreaks, and they said, look, we want to be ready for the next one. And they invested in a public health infrastructure to make sure that they would have testing capacity and contact tracing capacity for the next one. Well, this was the next one, and they were ready with those strategies. We were not. We had not invested in that kind of public health infrastructure, and so we were not ready to do that kind of testing. And to a large extent, we still aren't, or we still haven't embraced that strategy. We have more testing capacity now, certainly, than we did 8 months ago, but we haven't embraced that strategy on a national scale. So the other thing, so we can look at, you know, these other countries that are doing a lot of testing and see that, well, they don't all have the same increase in cases, so it's not just a function of testing. The other thing that we can look at is the percentage of tests that are coming back positive. If you are doing more testing and you're kind of finding those last few people that happen to be asymptomatic but still have it, right, you would expect that the percentage of tests that are coming back positive would either stay the same over time or go down because you're testing more and more people, most of whom don't have the virus, right? We know that not everybody has the virus. And so we would expect that as we test more people randomly, test people who aren't symptomatic, that we would see that percentage of positive tests go down. That is not what we've been seeing in many parts of the United States over the past weeks and in some cases months. We've seen that percentage of positive tests going up. So yes, we are testing more people, and yes, we may be finding more cases than we would have if we were testing fewer people, but it is not simply the case that we are finding more cases because we're doing more testing, and it's not because of a change in virus transmission. To explain that big percentage, to explain that increase in the percentage of tests that are coming back positive, that means that the people that we are testing now that we wouldn't have tested otherwise, you know, a few months ago because we were doing fewer testing, that more of them have the virus than the people that we were testing. So you're saying more people who are not sick have the virus than people who are sick. Well, we know that that's not the case. And so it has to be that the virus is spreading, and so we're seeing more spread of the virus, and that is why the percentage of tests are coming back positive, because there are just more people that have the virus now than had it
a few weeks ago. That is why, while there's some relationship between the amount of tests that you do and the amount of cases that you find, it is not simply the case that, oh, well, the U.S. is just doing a lot of testing and there really aren't any more people infected now than there were back in July or August when we were kind of at the most recent low point nationally. There is reason to think that there is more transmission now than there had been then. We also know that behavior has changed, right? People are reporting going to more events. Restaurants are operating at more capacity than they were previously. People are doing more things indoors because of the weather. And so, you know, the things that we know impact transmission have changed. So that's another reason why it's reasonable to think that there is some function of transmission going on here, not simply a function.
There was also, I think, another case for numbers increasing and you know, generally across the board increasing had to do with the increase in hospitalizations. And they've been saying along, you know, from the start that you see an increase in testing and then you see, you know, kind of 2 weeks later, then you see an increase in hospitalizations and it kind of follows that.
Right. So that's a very good point. That's part of the reason why we can say, well, it's not just that there are more people out there who are asymptomatic that have the virus than the people who are symptomatic, and that we're just finding them now. And that's why this not only is the absolute number of cases going up, but the percentage of tests that are coming back positive. It's not that there's some, you know, reservoir of infected but asymptomatic people that's just much bigger than we realize, because then we wouldn't, like you said, we wouldn't see this increase in hospitalizations because those people would all be well, they were, you know, and asymptomatic. But the fact that we're seeing an increase in hospitalizations of people with the coronavirus suggests that, yes, it is, in fact, an increase in transmission and more people are infected now than were, and thus more a percentage of those people who are infected going to the hospital. If there's a greater number of people who are infected, then that percentage of them who need the hospital is going to be, in absolute numbers, that number of people is going to go up as well.
So I guess since we're talking, still kind of talking about healthcare, I had a friend send a question, was saying how they were wondering if being exposed or getting your flu shot with people working in healthcare, if getting their flu shot provides some immunity to the disease. And I tried to answer, and then I realized that I am not the biologist, and so I probably should not try to answer. So we will talk to the actual biologist to get, you know, the real answer.
So that's a great question. So let's say a few things clearly as we can. First of all, getting the flu shot for most people is a good idea. Obviously, you need to consult with your physician. There are some people who are allergic to the one that's grown in chicken eggs, and so you want to be mindful of that and see if you can get an alternative, and so on and so forth. But generally speaking, it's a good idea to get your flu shot most years, and it is particularly a good idea to get your flu shot this year because we don't want to have a lot of people with influenza on top of a lot of people with COVID-19. Because they're going to need some percentage of those people are going to need the same hospital beds, the same physicians and nurses, same healthcare infrastructure that the COVID-19 patients are. So if we can keep flu cases down, then we can help limit the burden on our healthcare system at any given time. So that's number one. Number two, there is some evidence that vaccines in general help to encourage your innate immune response to be more active, or possibly to train it a little bit more to be more responsive. And so, for example, there have been studies that have indicated that perhaps the people who have gotten the flu vaccine in past years are more likely to be protected from COVID-19 infection. For example, there was a study in healthcare workers, and some of those healthcare workers have gotten the flu vaccine last year, and some of them didn't. And as we were looking at their experience over this past few months and whether they got COVID-19 or not in the course of their job or however, the healthcare workers who had gotten the influenza vaccine for last season were less likely to get COVID-19 than those who hadn't gotten the flu vaccine. It's unlikely that the vaccine is providing any kind of specific protection. Right? It's not like it's encouraging your body to make antibodies or to identify T cells that target specific coronavirus proteins. But it may be the case that the innate immune response, that first immune response that is not targeted specifically at any particular virus or bacterium, but just sort of generally responding to infections, that that may be responding more in a more targeted fashion or more quickly, or in some way is more active because of that sort of stimulus from the vaccine, right? And when you get a vaccine, all of your immune system reacts. What you're hoping to eventually get is that very specific adaptive response that's targeted very specifically to the virus or the bacterium or the parasite that you've been vaccinated against. But your whole immune system reacts. That's why in the first 24 hours after you get a vaccine, you might experience a low-grade fever or some swelling or pain in near the injection site. All that is that innate immune response saying, oh, something has happened. You know, there's a pathogen here. We have to respond and buy some time until this adaptive immunity kicks in. So both parts of the immune system respond to a vaccine, and it may be that that regular exposure to pathogens from the flu vaccine helps to get that innate immune response ramped up so that it can respond a little more quickly to the coronavirus. It may also be the case that those healthcare workers that make sure they get the flu vaccine every year are just generally a little bit more careful about their personal hygiene, about their personal protective equipment. They may work in different contexts exactly. And so it may be non-biological factors that determine the fact that they were a little bit more protected from COVID-19. But it may be that the vaccine provided some non-specific protection as well. There's another study going on looking at another vaccine that's developed against tuberculosis to see if it has a similar kind of generic immune system promoting response to protect against COVID-19. And there are still things that we don't completely understand about the innate immune response. So we may be learning some things as a result of these vaccine studies. So I would say that, you know, on balance, it's not going to hurt you to get the, it's very unlikely that it's going to have a negative effect if you get the flu vaccine, that it's going to make you more likely to get COVID-19. But the last point that I would make is that there's no evidence that the flu vaccine provides specific targeted protection against COVID-19 the way that a COVID-19 vaccine would. And so, sure, you know, right now we don't have a COVID-19 vaccine. So, you know, getting the flu vaccine, not a bad idea. Certainly will help you to be less likely to get the flu, or that if you do get the flu, to be less likely to have a severe case. But it may provide some limited protection against COVID-19. I wouldn't say then go out and just act as if, you know, you don't have to take any further precautions. You don't have to wear a mask. You don't have to wash your hands because you've gotten that flu vaccine. They definitely still continue to do all the same things, but it might provide some protection in, you know, while we are in this period without a vaccine. But certainly, if and when a coronavirus-specific vaccine becomes available, I wouldn't decline that because, oh, well, I already got my flu shot. Mm-hmm. You still want that very specific protection against the SARS coronavirus 2 that will be the best option for preventing either any infection or the most severe infections from that coronavirus.
Okay, I have a question to go back to the innate immune system. Mm-hmm. I thought, and it could be that I misremember or misunderstand some of the conversations we had in the past, I thought that our immune system was always on, like, so to speak, so that they're always, like, things, for lack of a better term right now, floating around in our bodies looking for, you know, foreign entities that could be making us sick.
Sure. You know, barring specific kinds of diseases and you know, heritable differences in immunity, yes, for most of us, our innate immune response and, you know, our memory of previous adaptive immune responses is always present. I wouldn't say it's always on, mm-hmm. exactly, but it's always ready to respond to something. But it's more a question of how quickly does it respond, mm-hmm. that I think can potentially be impacted by your history of vaccine exposure or possibly even your history of pathogen exposure, right? If you're somebody who has gotten a lot of other kind, you know, is exposed to lots of pathogens, whether you've gotten sick or not, mm-hmm. you may not know it. But if you're somebody who is exposed to a lot more pathogens, and so your immune system is kind of always a little bit more activated, it may then be more activated the next time you encounter something like the SARS coronavirus too. But yeah, so in general, the immune response, our immune system is kind of at a low level of readiness, like it's ready to respond, but it's not actually responding in any given moment.
I kind of feel like it might be like the threat levels for that you hear with like terrorism.
Yeah, or maybe, you know, and it's a crude analogy, but you can think of like the fire station, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there are, depending on how your fire department works locally, for some communities that have full-time fire departments, there's somebody who's always at the firehouse ready to respond to a fire. And so the rough analogy there would be that, yes, we always have these cells of our immune system, the various lymphocytes and neutrophils and all these different things that are always kind of probing to make sure that there are no pathogens around. But they're not actively responding, right? Just like those firemen and firewomen are at the station, they're not on the trucks hosing houses down in advance of, and just in case they catch on fire, right? They're waiting there at the firehouse for that
call. I just have this ridiculous, like, picture of, okay, we're here to squirt down your house for today.
Right, and that would be a bad thing, right? Because, in general, our houses don't do well to that volume of water, right? That's one of the things you have to deal with if you have a serious fire in your house. Not only is there the smoke and the fire damage, but then there's also a lot of water that needs to be cleaned up as well, and that can be damaging. It's kind of the same, you know, again, it's a very crude analogy.
Kind of similar to like an autoimmune.
Yeah. So, you know, that's kind of like what's happened in some autoimmune diseases. That's kind of, again, in a very rough analogy, what is happening is that kind of going around and spraying down the houses when they don't need to be. You're reacting to something that isn't
like when
there.
I have a cookie.
In your case, yes. Yeah. Yeah, so we don't necessarily want our immune system on all the time, just like we don't want the fire department always spraying our houses with tons of water.
Okay.
But we do want them to be ready should there be something that does need to be dealt with. And so, you know, this kind of training or activation or whatever might be happening, this sort of nonspecific reactions that might be happening from getting regular vaccinations, might be maybe the difference between, you know, a fire department that has, you know, full-time staff in the station versus the volunteer fire departments that everybody, you know, has to come when the alarm goes off and then go out. You know, it might just be that difference in the response time is just a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I'm, again, not trying to criticize anybody's structure of their fire departments or anything like that, but there is a difference in how these things work. And likewise, you know, it may be a slight difference in how the immune response reacts in those kinds of settings.
So thank you for my friend who sent the question. So please feel free to, you know, out there in the world, if you have questions, send them. And I will do better to pass them on to you instead of trying to answer them myself.
You know, we all want to be helpful. And so it's a natural response.
Yes. But we also got some good news with vaccines. Since we're talking about vaccines. It's a good segue.
We don't have a SARS coronavirus 2 vaccine yet that has been approved and ready to be administered, but we are getting closer. So the big news this past week, the Pfizer and BioNTech group that has put together a vaccine candidate has had enough cases in their study. So remember, they're looking at tens of thousands. So I believe the last number I saw was 44,000 people enrolled in their study. They've had enough COVID-19 infections or cases in that study group to be able to see a difference between the two groups. The number I saw there was 94. So remember, and we talked about this way back at the beginning, that we're not looking for all 44,000 of those people to get exposed and get sick. But what we need to do is include enough people in the study so that a couple hundred, you know, get exposed and get infected so we can see a measurable difference between the two groups. So that is kind of the point that they had reached where they felt like, okay, there's enough people that have had an outcome that we can see if there's a measurable difference. And what those preliminary results found, a review by an independent group looked at their data and found that there was an over 90% protection level. So that meant that your chances of getting COVID-19, if you were in the vaccine group, were more than 90% reduced from the chances of getting it if you were in the placebo group. So to put it crudely, you know, if 10 people in the placebo group got COVID-19, one person in the vaccine group got COVID-19, would be, you know, one way that those numbers work out, or 110, that kind of thing. And actually, it was more than 90%, so it would be maybe 106 or 104. Mm-hmm. They didn't give an exact number on it. That is not a final conclusion of the study. They have to wait until they have 2 months of safety data on every participant. So that means you got, and this is a two-dose vaccine. You got your first dose, you wait a couple weeks, get your second dose, and then from that point, they have to wait 2 months to see what kind of reactions you might have to the vaccine. Make sure that there are no adverse events that need to be dealt with or that need to be reckoned with. So once they've completed that 2 months of safety data on all 44,000 people in the study, that's when they can conclude the study and report the results to the FDA to get potential. It'll probably be a similar pipeline to what has happened before. There'll be a first stage of an emergency authorization and then a full approval. So they haven't published the full data from their study. I don't know when that will happen. They haven't gotten any kind of even emergency authorization for the vaccine. So nobody's getting this vaccine yet outside of the people who've already gotten it in this clinical trial.
And these are people from all over. I just happened to hear one of the local news stories that there was, you know, a local man up just north of here who got it and was saying how, I mean, he doesn't know if he got the placebo or right. the official, but whatever, he has been part of the study. He felt very comfortable being part of the study, and he was very excited.
Yeah, many of these vaccines are being tested around the world. You know, there are several, I think four phase three clinical trials going on here in the United States, in various parts of the country. You know, they want to try and enroll people from as many different places, as many different kinds of people as possible to make sure they're getting representative data. This particular vaccine, you know, Pfizer is an American company, BioNTech is a German company, so I believe there was an arm of the study going on in Germany as well. And so, yeah, so, you know, there's lots of people involved from all over the place. It's not just, you know, they don't just, you know, roll up at Pfizer headquarters and be like, all right, you know, go outside and round up the first 44,000 people you see. That, you know, they're very deliberate in how they design these studies. And then they review the data on a regular basis. You know, so the people who get the treatments, either the vaccine or the placebo, they don't know what they're getting. Mm-hmm. People who are administering it don't know what they're getting. But somebody has a full data set. They know who has gotten what, so they can determine if the vaccine people did better than the placebo people. And so that data gets reviewed periodically. And that's all part of making sure that these clinical trials are safe and ethical. Right? They want to make sure that if there are adverse reactions that are serious, that they respond to those as quickly as possible. So we've talked about that some of these trials have been paused for a while, which means they stopped enrolling new people while they figured out what had caused these adverse reactions and if it was serious enough and related to the vaccine to warrant just saying, nope, this vaccine cannot be given to any more people. That hasn't, you know, they've reviewed that. They've not determined that about this vaccine. Safety profile has, again, as reported from these initial results, has been acceptable.
And the interview that I saw with this you know, participant, he was saying that he was required to check his temperature, kind of log into, you know, some kind of form and answer questions, and, you know, that there was a different, that the questions that he was having to answer kind of changed as weeks went on, and so he no longer has to check his temperature every day. Like, and I thought that was really, you know, interesting that it was not just a you sign up, roll up your sleeve, and
yeah,
we'll call you, kind of. But it was, you know, you, this person was also kind of actively, you know, participating.
Right. And you know, that's what we want. And that's how these things are run, so that we're getting clearer data. And yeah, I would expect that the questions would change. You know, we would expect that some number of people who get the vaccine will have a fever the first 1, 2, 3 days afterwards, some period of time, as that innate immune response kicks in. Your body is saying there's something in here that wasn't here before that doesn't normally belong here. And so your immune reaction kicks in. Part of that can be a fever. So that doesn't mean that people are having no responses or no reactions to the vaccine. I would imagine that some people in the study group experienced fever, experienced soreness around the injection site, things that are common with lots of vaccines. It doesn't mean the vaccine isn't safe. It means that it is within the standard, you know, range of what we consider to be acceptable for vaccines. And part of that range has to exist because we want your immune system. We want your immune system to react. If no one ever had any sort of reaction or any of these symptoms, that would kind of suggest that maybe the vaccine wasn't doing anything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a balance of making sure that we're getting enough of a reaction that it will work, but not so much of a reaction that it's causing harm in and of itself. So they're going to be asking those kinds of questions. You know, a month and a half in, if a participant gets a fever, that shouldn't be from the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that could be from, you know, they could have gotten any number of other things. And they may follow up on that, you know, if that person seeks healthcare, but they're not going to be, they're not going to be actively checking for that sort of thing on an ongoing basis, because that wouldn't be related to the vaccine at that point. And they are also going to be checking, does it appear to be working? You know, they don't want to enroll all 44,000 people if they get partway through and they can say, oh, look, there have been this many cases in the vaccine group and this many cases in the placebo group, and they're really about the same. Statistically, there's no difference between them. And we've enrolled enough people, say maybe they've gotten to the 20,000 people mark point. And they can say, we've enrolled enough people that if it doesn't look like there's any difference now, it's very, very unlikely that there will be a difference once we get all the people enrolled. Mm-hmm. So we're just going to call it now and say that it's not appropriate to give more people this vaccine, right?
And that's important too, because they don't want to give people a false sense of security,
right? And we don't want to invest, you know, time and money, mm-hmm. and ask a lot of, you know, because we're asking a lot of these participants,
mm-hmm.
We don't want to ask that of people if there's no reason to think that it's going to be worthwhile. So that's why we kind of do these regular checks of the data. So it's, you know, it's perfectly within the bounds that they have done this preliminary data check. At the same time, it's not the final result. Hopefully we'll get that final result soon. I believe that certainly by the end of the month, and possibly even as early as this week, that 2-month safety window will have elapsed for all of the participants. And so they'll be able to collate the final data and submit that, you know, presumably they'll submit that for publication somewhere, and presumably they'll submit that to the FDA for that either emergency authorization or, you know, actual full approval. You know, in the timeline, the optimistic but, you know, plausible timeline is that starting in December, people will be getting doses of this vaccine. And we may also be in a similar time frame for the Moderna vaccine. They're not quite, you know, they didn't release the same kind of preliminary findings, but their clinical trial is on a similar-ish time frame that, you know, probably by the end of the year, if it also turns out well, that people could be getting doses of that vaccine too. Most likely that will be healthcare workers first, probably also some other people in high-risk categories, such as older folks. I don't know that the final plan on that has been fully disseminated. And so who exactly fits into those high-risk categories or high-priority categories has been fully determined, or at least, you know, published. But, you know, the likely candidates are, you know, fairly straightforward to identify. So you know, the average person may not be able to go to their physician or to the hospital or to, you know, Walgreens or whatever on December 1st and ask for this vaccine and get it. Some people will be getting it. The highest priority, the highest risk people should be able to start getting it, assuming that it passes, assuming that these preliminary results are indicative of the final results and that it passes approval. that by December some folks will be getting it. So yeah, by the first quarter of next year, everybody should be able to, or at least adults, as we discussed before, it's unlikely this, you know, these trials haven't included children, and so it probably won't be licensed for children right away. But adults should be able to go and speak to their physician or hospital, or exactly how it'll be distributed, I don't know. But you'll be able to ask for it and get it, even if you aren't in the highest risk groups, sometime next year. And if it's appropriate, we'll talk more about that and the details of that when they come. But certainly we're looking forward to that being the case. And we hope that the final results of this trial and the final results of some of the other trials turn out to be as encouraging as these initial results are. Yeah. So that's some good news. Maybe a
so
good place to end.
So we end up with some good news.
Yeah. It's not the final answer, but it's an encouraging step in the right direction.
It's still been an amazing achievement for this, you know, stretch of time.
I mean, you think about, we are, you know, I don't remember exactly the day, or
it's like we get a baby.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the 9 month, yeah, I was just thinking about, you know, it was sometime, you know, a year ago that the first person was infected with this virus. So we're talking about, in the span of a year, we went from no human being ever having contracted this virus, because this particular form of the virus did not exist. Right, it evolved into this form of the virus sometime last year. And within that year, we have identified it and created multiple encouraging vaccine candidates. And that is remarkable. And yeah, hopefully we'll have some further good news to share about that in due time.
Yep.
So if you have...
So where do you find us?
if you have questions about that, or you're excited to, and you want to share your enthusiasm, you can get in touch with us, biobreakpod@gmail.com or @biobreakpod on Twitter, or you can look for Biobreak Podcast on Facebook. And we would love to hear from any and all of you. And until that time, take care of yourselves, wear your masks, and be well.
Stay home.